3, 2, 1. Good afternoon.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you today, Tom?
I'm doing great.
Good.
So what do I call you? Danny? Danielle?
Whatever you fancy. Danny?
Well, what I mean, Danielle? You know, what you go by. I tell you what, first maybe we'll just have you introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Danielle First, or Danny. What else would you like me to say about myself?
Well, I mean, you know, the premise of the podcast is really, you know, about people that live in Rehoboth. Oh. You know, what keeps you here, what brought you here, the fun things you do here.
All right.
So what do you do here? I know you have a lot of facets to your life, and I've been thinking about, you know, which way we should go with this podcast, but I'm just going to let it kind of play out.
Let's let it flow.
But you do a lot of fun stuff.
I do.
Music.
Life is good. Yes, music. I live on a farm. I live in a yurt.
Well, and someone's like, talk to her about the yurt.
It's a very interesting talking point. It's a, you know.
Yeah. Well, what is a yurt?
What is a yurt?
We might as well just go with the yurt.
A yurt is it's a temporary structure that is circular. It's a very glamorous tent, I guess you could say.
Glamping.
Glamping, yeah. It's actually an ancient Mongolian structure. They were nomads, so they put up these yurts, and they're easily broken down, and they just kind of moved where they went. So,
do you guys own the land?
It's a family plot of land, so yes, it's.
I didn't know
owned
what the rule
Nathan's
was if
family.
You could just put a yurt anywhere.
They're temporary structures, so it can go on a piece of land where there is an existing house, which is the case on our farm. But you don't need a permit, you don't pay taxes for it, so it's.
When you've been doing the yurt, you guys
almost 3 years. We've been living in the
yurt. 3 years.
Yeah.
Are you digging it?
Yeah.
Are you digging it?
We love it. We love it. We're very attached to it. We are looking to upgrade. We're looking to build a house. We're looking for land.
I talked to you, I don't know, a while back, and I think you mentioned you guys were looking for land. But then I thought, I wonder at some point, do you just start digging the yurt and stay in it?
We're having a hard time letting go of it. You know, we're very attached to it. We built it, and it's really cool. I mean, we sleep under the stars. We have a window that's directly over our head. So, I mean, we can see the stars when we go to sleep and wake up with the day. And
you guys live there year round.
We do. Yeah.
Winter. Summer.
Yep. Winter, spring, summer, and fall.
How is winter in the yurt?
It's a little nippy.
Okay.
Yurts are supposed to have wood stoves, and we didn't put a wood stove in there, and we thought, well, we don't really want to be inhaling, you know, a lot of smoke. Those days are over.
Right.
So we thought we would go a different route, but we realized that, you know, that keeps it nice and toasty in the winter. It also zaps moisture in there. So, you know, we've definitely live and learn on some
of
these
things.
Did you
ever get a wood stove?
No, we didn't get a wood stove.
So how do you heat it?
So we have a split system that's a heater / AC.
Okay.
And it does really well, except when it drops below freezing for, you know, extended period of time, and then we lose our heat. So we have kind of space heaters and electric blankets, and we wear our coats.
We had a pretty mild winter.
It wasn't bad this winter. Oh. Last year was a lot worse.
I always think of the worst part of winter is like February.
February.
But December is really when it can get. You know, there's those. We've had a couple weeks in December, maybe early January, where I actually think about, you know, because I don't live in a yurt. I live in a house, but it's, you know, it's a double wide for the most part.
Right.
And it's on a foundation, but, you know, all around the foundation are these little vents. And 1 year I opened all the vents up for summer because it can get a little humid under there. And I didn't close them back up, and my pipe started to freeze. And I was like, oh, geez. And that was probably a few years back, so I closed them all. But I think this past, maybe it was 2 years ago, we had a little spell. But I think we had a little one in December where it was pretty chilly, but nothing too bad.
No, it wasn't a bad winter at all.
So you guys have fun with it?
We have fun. We do. We watched all of Game of Thrones, you know, during the winter. We said, winter is coming, so let's, you know, get weird.
The dead are coming.
We just layered ourselves with, you know, animal skins and just got weird in there, so.
Did you watch that's funny you even said that, because I was watching, I guess it was Game of Thrones last weekend, and there was a scene where I think Cersei, the crazy queen,
right.
I think she was laying in a bed of just furs.
Yes.
And I thought, I could go for that.
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of
looks,
furs, but
I know, right?
It looks like it might get a little warm, though.
Yeah. A little toasty.
Yeah. Are you guys a big fan of the show?
We are. Game of Thrones? We are. Yes.
I love the show.
Yeah.
I forgot to watch it last night.
We have streaming, so we watch it on Mondays.
Oh, tonight's the night.
That's the night. We're excited.
So what do you use to stream?
We have, in the yurt, we have a Roku.
Okay.
And so we have Netflix and Prime, and we have internet.
So what do you watch on, like, on HBO Go?
We have HBO Go. Yeah.
Is that what you watch Game of Thrones on?
Yeah.
HBO Go?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. but you have to watch it the next day. It's kind of like Hulu.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because honestly, I mean, we went, you know, this happens. I had Comcast, and my bill was up to like $238 at one point. Mm-hmm. And I finally said, you know what? I'm done. And shut it off.
Yeah.
And just had the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And did that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Christine and I met, she's like, oh, my God, I love TV. So I said, I'll bring back one cable box for the living room. Mm-hmm. And the guy, it was funny. It was like a Seinfeld episode. The guy's like, we want you back.
Right.
And I was like, you know, like, remember when Kramer was hiding from the cable guy?
Yes.
We're sorry. But he's like, hey, you know, listen, we want you back. And I'll be your, you know, your liaison. Your, you know, everything goes through me. If you have any problems, call me. And I was like, yeah, I really like the idea. Well, I lost his number, first of all. And, you know, a couple years later, and the bill's creeping up to a couple $100 again.
No.
And
yep, I get you.
I think about dropping it again, but there's a couple. We love A&E. We love Live PD. For some reason, we love that show. We'll watch it all weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And, we did look into the Sling TV, and Sling TV offers A&E. So, you know, it's not gotten to a point where I'm ready to dump it now, but.
Uh-huh.
It was great. You know, it's like breaking up with cable for a while, but you know, you're sad and you mope around, but then you start figuring out, okay, this is what I got.
Yeah.
And you watch it.
Exactly.
And you're fine.
Yeah, you're fine.
But it sounds like you guys aren't really suffering too bad because you still get like Game of Thrones and stuff.
Yeah, no, the streaming has been working really well. Speaking of using, you mentioned Hulu, and my last project was with Hulu actually called Fire Fraud. So I composed the score to that, and it was a real surprise, kind of went viral. It was a really big hit, and just found out that we're going to be submitted for an Emmy nomination for that. So,
for the music?
Yeah.
So I might be doing a podcast with the future Emmy nominee.
There's a chance.
There's
a chance. So it's exciting. Yeah.
Well, and I'll just tell you, you know, I know you, and we know each other like through James and Ann and stuff, and Rob. But and I know you're a musician.
Yes,
I know you play piano down at the Blue Moon.
Yep, that's
do you
one
still
of the
do
places.
That?
Yes,
that's one of your gigs.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also this other side, and we're friends also on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I know you seem like a simple person, but then you're off to like Hollywood.
Yeah,
and you're working with people like who's the guy, Beyonce's husband?
Jay-Z.
I mean, did you work with Jay-Z?
Jay-Z was the executive producer on two of the series that I scored, so I got to meet him.
You get to live like this little simple life in
Rehoboth,
and then
you're off
to like Hollywood.
I know it's a wild life.
Do you want to talk about that?
Sure.
How do you get involved in that?
Yeah. Well, so I was born into a musical artistic family, and my father was a very talented pianist and composer. And it was evident, you know, I've been playing the piano since I was in diapers. I don't remember being alive and not playing the piano. So, I mean, it was before I could talk or walk. And my father saw this, and so he trained me and taught me how to make a living around music in every way. So he taught me how to teach music. He taught me how to compose. He taught me how to perform. You know, how do you have a steady gig? You need a repertoire. You know, what kind of song should I learn? And he put me in my first cocktail lounge when I was 13 years old, you know, playing for all the regulars in there, moonlighting
people.
For the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he taught me also how to sell pianos because he was running a very successful piano business. So he taught me, you know, here are your choices. You know, you love music, you love piano. Here's all the things you can do around it. So I've pretty much done everything around piano since then. the writing, the composing started a little bit later on, I would say, in my early 20s. And my younger brother found the film. He found the camera, and he fell in love with telling stories. And the, one of the first pieces of music I ever wrote, I shared it with him, and he said, "That's cinematic, Danny. That's cinematic. You know, you should score films." And I'm thinking, yeah. Well, fast forward a couple of years, and my brother's directing his first feature film, and he calls me and he says, "I want you to score my movie." And I thought, find someone in New York, you know. I mean, I had a lot going on at the time, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm sure you could find someone near you. And he said, "Get on the plane. I'll buy you a ticket. Get on the plane. You're scoring my movie. I believe in you. I want you to do this with me."
Well, most people don't have brothers that are making movies.
Right.
You know.
Right. I mean, and he was just starting out. He was an independent film. And he was right out of college. And he flew me to New York. I got on the plane. I did what he said. You know, I was there for 3 days. And I completely fell in love with the whole experience. It really was very affirming for me. You know, I was put together with a producer, and he said, "You know, you can do this. You can do this." And time stopped. I felt like I can be in a studio all day, every day. This is the ultimate thing for me to be doing.
Your dream.
This is my dream. This is the culmination of everything.
Or maybe you didn't know it was your dream, but
I figured it out at that moment that this is what I need to be doing.
That's kind of cool when you can stumble into a dream.
Yes, exactly, you know? Exactly. So. It turned out that it was something that I could do, and I loved it. And so that was very exciting. And that was about 10 years ago, and he made a second film. And in a second film, he's like, "All right, you're doing it." And I'm like, "Yep."
How did the first film do? Did it
was
get
great.
Picked
it
up?
Was,
or, I don't
it
know
was
how that
a,
works.
It was, it's called Dirty Old Town. It is, it's an independent, very New York, you know, movie, kind of dark comedy. And, you know, we had a premiere in New York City, and it was a lot of fun. And it's just one of these, you know, it's just his first feature film. His second feature film is called Houses. And that was a few years later. And at that point, he put me together with who is now my partner, my music partner. And him and I just really hit it off. His name is Kari Mateen. He's based out of Los Angeles. That's why I go there a lot. That's mm-hmm. like my second home. And him and I, we just have this synergy. We just complete each other's, you know, my strengths are his weaknesses and vice versa.
Yeah.
And he's a very talented producer. He's a very talented cellist and composer, and he's LA based. And, my brother introduced us, and it was just, we work really, really well together. So we did a film together called Houses, which starred a couple people from The Sopranos. I don't know if you're a Sopranos fan.
Oh, yeah,
but,
I love Sopranos.
Christopher, Michael yeah. Imperioli yeah. was one of the stars. Steve Sciarippa, who plays Bacalao. And
what was his girlfriend's name in The Sopranos?
Which, Christopher?
Yeah.
Wasn't it Adriana? Yeah.
Adriana. Adriana. He used to have that. I used yeah. to crack up. I used to say that. Like,
yeah.
No.
Yes.
That's actually very cool.
Yep. And so we did the music for that one. That's a really, really cool independent film also. And so those were the two movies that I did. And what happened after that is that, you know, my brother is just working hard in New York. Him and his wife own like a mom and pop production house called the Cinemart. And they were working on this... trailer or teaser that for what they were going to make a documentary about Kalief Browder, who was a 16-year-old African-American boy that was basically plucked off the street in the Bronx for allegedly stealing a backpack, which he didn't, and he was thrown in Rikers, and he was kept there for, I think it was 3.5 years or 4 years, two of which were in solitary confinement. I mean, he was tortured, and his story got, you know, a lot of press, and it basically was kind of the beginning of Black Lives Matter. And my brother and his team were making that into a documentary, and simultaneously, while that was happening, I mean, the stars aligned, simultaneously Jay-Z and Harvey Weinstein had signed a contract to make a couple television projects. They didn't know what they were going to make the television projects about, but mm-hmm. they decided that they were going to merge and make some TV. So people were at the right place at the right time. One of Jay-Z's, you know, right-hand people was at an event with someone who knew that my brother was working on this film, I think at the lawyer for Khalif Browder, and they were all brought together, and Jay-Z had met Khalif Browder before he committed suicide, and it was something that was very, like, close to his heart.
Oh, I didn't know. So he killed himself.
Khalif Browder killed himself a little less than a year out of Rikers when he finally got released. He was so damaged from, I mean, he was a child, and he was, I mean, someone, an adult being in solitary for a week, the damage, you know, is apparent. But for a young person to be in solitary for years, you know.
Can't imagine
what that'd be like. He was innocent. And so anyway, he was released and he committed suicide not long after. So Jay-Z had met him before he committed suicide. So it was something that was very close to his heart. So he found out that this project was happening and he said, this is our first TV project. So all of a sudden it just kind of, you know, blew up from there. And my brother wanted to work with me and Kari, and he wanted us to be with him on this series. So that's how that started.
Wow.
And that was back in 2016. That's when I started going to Los Angeles and staying out there for a month at a time. I would say I spend maybe 3 months out of the year total there.
Yeah.
And so the first project was called Time, the Khalif Browder story, and that's now on Netflix. It aired on Spike TV. We actually, the team won a Peabody Award, which was a real huge honor. Then because of that, Jay-Z and Harvey Weinstein got the rights for the Trayvon Martin story, and they came to the Cinemark, my brother and his wife, and they came to our team again to do that, which was another really big deal for all of us. So we all did that.
And Trayvon, he was the remind us who he was.
Trayvon Martin was shot and killed by George Zimmerman. Trayvon Martin was another kid. I mean, I think he was 17 years old. And he was shot and killed by George Zimmerman, who was a neighborhood watch.
Yes. Now I remember.
And George Zimmerman was not in prison for this. He was, you know, let off. The trial was an absolute joke. And so it was just a horrible, horrible tragedy. And it really polarized, you know, white and black. And, you know, it was one of those really big, huge, you know, cases. And that we're still feeling the ramifications of today. So that series really explored all of it. You know, there was a lot of interviews on both sides. Really went into the trial. It really, you know, went into George Zimmerman, you know, because he's a real loose cannon.
Yeah. And he's had more more problems since then.
Yeah, a lot of problems. So that was a really emotional, huge project for us. And that one aired on Paramount Network, and we had our premiere at Tribeca. I got to meet Trayvon's parents, and so that was huge. So that happened. So those were two really heavy, important stories to tell. And then this fire fraud thing was really meant to just be a fun little project that was going to be in between Trayvon and this next big one I'm currently working on, which is a Netflix original series about the birth of the opioid crisis in New Orleans.
Oh,
so that's
boy.
Another real heavy one.
Yeah.
So this fire fraud thing was just like, okay, we're, you know, going to tell this story.
Now, is fire fraud, I'm going to just guess, is that about that music festival?
Yes. The fire festival.
Yes.
Exactly.
I watched that on Netflix.
Well, so funny you should. So, yes, there's two documentaries, and the Hulu documentary that I worked on that my brother and his wife directed, Julia Nason. Yeah, you should watch the Hulu one if you have Hulu.
Yeah, I have it.
Because it actually explains why there's two documentaries. And so there's a lot of kind of controversy about that. Some of the people that actually produced the Netflix one, they were part of promoting the scam.
Right.
So it's almost like in response to Hulu coming out.
Now, was that, I mean, was it even, I mean, did, Was it a scam? I mean, I know it ended up. I mean, I just saw, I was watching something about somebody that went to jail who is currently in jail. Oh, the guy, Trump's fixer guy. Mm-hmm. They just took him to federal prison with mm-hmm. the guy from the MTV Jersey Shore show, and then the guy that started the Fyre Music Festival. But was it a scam? I mean, or did it just not work out? And he got in over his head because, I mean, I think initially they really were trying to have a
initially
music festival.
They were trying to, yes. Initially they were trying to. The Hulu doc, Fyre Fraud, really goes into the backstory of Billy McFarlane, who, you know, was the one who was planning this and responsible. He's been doing these kind of schemes or whatever since he was a kid.
Right.
And, you know, Ponzi schemes, basically. So yes, they definitely had every intention of having a music festival, but it was clear really early on that they weren't going to be able to pull it off.
And they just kept going.
And they kept going. And even you know, months in advance when vendors were pulling out and the musical acts were pulling out and there was no way, like logistically, it was going to happen, the marketing team, and they kept promoting it like, nope, it's going to happen. They were blocking things on Twitter so that anything that came up with like a hashtag scam or festival or whatever was being monitored and deleted.
Well, I was just recently, and they were kind of reminding me of that, was this they want to do this Woodstock 50. And right. They'd been talking about doing the festival and, you know, it was a big deal. And then I saw something that says, you know, the people, the financial support of the festival were mm-hmm. like, we're not doing this. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
There's too many people. We can't keep them safe. And then I just saw yesterday something that says from the festival, like, we're still doing the festival. You know, ignore them. But it kind of reminded me of, you know, it's not going to work, but we're going to do it.
Right.
And I was watching a Joe Rogan podcast with Be Real. The mm-hmm. guy from I forget the name of a rap act, you know, mm-hmm. The ones that really promoted smoking pot. I forget the guys, but anyway,
Snoop Dogg?
Not Snoop Dogg. It was that's so bad. But
okay.
They were at that Woodstock festival, and they said that they played for like 350,000 people, and they were showing. But he goes, you know, they flew us in, and they said, you know, the show's, you're done, get on the helicopter and get out, because we can't guarantee you'll get out if you don't take the helicopter now. It was just that out of control. And I'm sure that that's what they were trying to prevent. But
yeah,
sorry, I didn't mean to progress.
No, it's okay. No, it's okay. So that's essentially what happened with, you know, with the Fyre Fest. And a lot of people lost a lot of money. And the worst part was, you know, the locals in the Bahamas that really suffered. And thanks to, you know, the documentaries coming out, there's been a lot of GoFundMes that have helped them recover.
So how did they get hurt?
How did the Bahamas?
Yeah. Because I think they were going to do this music festival on mm-hmm. like this old cocaine guy's island, right?
Yeah, Escobar.
Yeah, Escobar's island. He owned the island. So, but was it like the Bahamas was like a stopping point to get there? Was that
no, just the island that they were on in the Bahamas. The locals, there was a restaurant owner that they had, you know, all the people come in as like a stopping point, and she just lost a ton of money.
Got screwed over.
But they're... From what I heard, they raised a good amount of money for her after the documentaries came out, and
that's sad. Got
her some retribution. But the maintenance people, I mean, the people just got screwed left and right.
Yeah.
Not to mention the people that spent money on these tickets and showed up. You know, they were promised 5-star accommodations, catering. You know, there was that classic cheese sandwich that was, you know, total went viral on Twitter. That's the food they had. No water. I mean, there was a lot of booze.
There was a lot of. There was also some people that weren't like, you know, it's almost like this is what you get. It's almost like this group of people that, and you know, and I haven't read into it or looked into it that much, but there was a lot of people that were like, you know, if you're going to spend $10,000,
yeah,
I don't know.
Poor rich millennials. Yeah, is that what it was? For you.
Poor rich millennials.
No, I mean, that's why it got so much attention, because, you know, really it was these rich kids that, you know, were paying $50,000 to go to this music festival. And, you know, but it really was, I mean, the footage they had when they all got there, I mean, it was like Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
I mean, it was mayhem. They were trapped there. They couldn't get out. Yeah, there were disaster FEMA tents, you know, people running around.
They looked like Utes.
Yeah.
Kind of like mini Utes. It was an island of Utes.
Yep, it was.
I did watch it. I was, the thing that I thought was the strangest is that the kids, like, they were offering a, you know, you could sit on a plane and take a picture with your Instagram of you on a plane to post to your friends, like, look at me, I'm on a plane.
Right.
And, you know, Christine and I just went to, we went to Mexico, went to Breathless was a resort. But it was full of that kind of thing. You know, these people would just sit there, these groups of guys, or it'd be like a couple guys and like 10 supermodel girls, young girls.
Right.
And they would just sit on the beach and just take pictures of themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that there's the Kardashians, these product kind of people. You know, if you get enough people looking at your...
Influencers.
Influencers, that's what they're called.
That's what Fyre Festival really capitalized on, were these Instagram influencers that said they were going, and they would pay them a large sum of money to say they were going, or to, you know, promote it. And so all their followers would then book tickets and want to go. And it's this thing called FOMO, you know, fear of missing out, that really is what drove this to be what it is. So the Hulu documentary really goes into to that, you know, just society as a whole and just socioeconomic, you know, influences, and just looking at this whole social media millennial culture, really looking into Billy McFarland as a child, see like how, you know, how he got to be where he is. And he's not stopping. I mean, he's in prison right now and he's still scheming and scamming and, you know he's just like,
has he done anything that was a success? Has he done anything that makes him legit?
I mean, all the things that were his claim to fame. I mean, he had this like credit card called Magnesis, which was this, you know, this metal card, and it was supposed to be the American Express black card for millennials, I guess. And that also was kind of a big scam, and tickets, you know, events, and, you know, he's a fascinating character, but man, he really screwed over a lot of people.
He pulls a lot of people in with him.
Yeah. I mean, he's in prison legitimately for fraud, you know, millions of dollars of fraud.
Federal prison. And so. And when I watched that documentary on Netflix, there was no finale, or there was no, they didn't really say what happened to him. He was just kind of figuring it out. I don't know, shucking and jiving.
Right.
Hiding and avoiding.
But
I didn't know he was in prison until I saw that thing
in October that happened. But he actually, on the Hulu doc, has real live interviews with him. So that's one of the big differences between the two of them. But the Netflix, you know, the documentary, it's a fine documentary. It's just the people that produced it are actually responsible for, you know, continuing the scam. It's a media company called, excuse my language, but they're called Fuck Jerry. And that's what they're called.
That's a good name.
And they're behind the Netflix documentary. And when you watch the Hulu at the end, it explains, oh, now there's going to be two documentaries, and this is, you know, their stance. And so it was kind of like a rebuttal in a lot of ways. I don't know.
So the Hulu's ones is a little more
Hulu. The Hulu revealing. One is revealing. It definitely looks more at, you know, society as a whole. It has original music, whereas the Netflix one does not.
Right. Your original music.
Yes. Me and Kari's original music. So that was...
Well, that's kind of cool that I didn't realize I knew someone that was so, you know, big time.
Please.
Well, you know what? That's big time. I think that's really cool.
No, thank you. No, I appreciate that. We did not expect for that documentary to get so much play. It's funny. I'm driving in my car and I hear an ad for Spotify, and they said, oh, with your Spotify, we'll give you Hulu so you can watch movies like Fyre Fraud and Handmaid's Tale. I was like, what?
Those are yours.
Well, Handmaid's Tale is not, but Handmaid's Tale is huge. It's just funny to hear. So you can watch Fire Fraud and Handmaid's Tale.
Isn't that funny when you start being involved? It's like if you start doing something and you get recognized for it.
Yeah, it is.
So what's it like when you, because we live in, we went to, Christine and I went to Christiana Mall on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, back to reality. I mean, there's a big world out there. Yeah. You know, we live in such a small little town. I mean, it's got a few people that come in and out of the town, but for the most part, we're kind of in this half. I mean, we have the ocean on one side and farm on the other. So what's it like to go from here to go spend, what do you say, 3 months in LA or?
Yeah, I'll go there for a month at a time. And I grew up in, I've always lived in big cities.
Okay.
You know, that's something, you know, I grew up in Boston. I lived in New York City. I lived in Miami for a long time, lived in London. So I guess I kind of, I need to have some time in a big city.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to always live in a big city. I really like the way that things are going right now. I like the balance that I have. It's working right now. Because I don't have too much of the farm life, small town, you know, and I don't have too much of this crazy manic, you know, city. But I feel like I need both. Like I need to have that balance, and it helps me creatively because when I go to the big city, when I go to, you know, Los Angeles, it's become, like I said, like a home away from home. Luckily, I have very close friends there. I have people I've known my whole life. So that's like very grounding because it can be a really wild place, mm-hmm. you know. I have a community there. And it's very creative. I plug in. I feel really inspired. But it also takes a toll, you know. So by the time I'm it's time for me to go, I'm ready to go and I'm ready to come home and really decompress. And that's really kind of how my work schedule is. It's really intense, go, go, go for a month where it's just like this huge output creatively. We're in the studio, you know, 8 hours sometimes a day, doing just really a lot, you know, just really putting out a huge amount of work. And then by the time I get home, I'm just ready to, you know, collapse and just hang out in the yurt and, you know, relax.
I've always considered myself a big city guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I grew up in Albuquerque, which was, it was a big city for that area at the time. And then I moved here from San Diego and, but that was in 94.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've even heard just in, since like 96, 94, 95, 96, it's and I'm like, where do all these people, I could barely afford to live in this one bedroom.
Yeah.
I mean, it was basically a two bedroom apartment that mm-hmm. somebody cut in half and mm-hmm. my front door was a sliding glass door.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, I barely could afford to live there and there's so many people there.
Yeah.
I just don't get it. How do they pull that off? I mean, is this just everyone renting?
Looks like it. Yeah.
A lot
of
renters.
That's what it seems like. Yeah. A lot of renters.
I've had friends that, they'll go out to San Diego and then they'll come back and they're like, oh my God, we want to move there.
Mm.
And I go, okay. And then off they go. They go move there. And then, you know, 6-7 years later, spits them out.
Yeah.
And they come tumbling back. Oh.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess it's nice you get to go there and then you get
it
to
is.
Back
I like
here.
Being, I like, being able to go there, I'm it's a lot of fun. It's an adventure. I feel
nice
very
weather.
Lucky. Nice weather. I'm, you know, doing what I love. I'm making a living doing what I love and getting to hang out in Los Angeles for a month. But I also love coming home. There's just nothing like it.
Have you taken Nathan out there?
He hasn't come out there with me yet.
He'd be like, whoa,
but
my God.
I think he would really love it. Not so much the city aspect of it, but the coastline and the nature and, you know, Big Sur and just the Pacific Ocean and just all of that. He would really dig it.
He's one of the cooler guys I've ever met. I mean,
yeah, he really is. He's why I'm here in Delaware. I mean, he brought me here, you know. No other reason do I live in Delaware because of Nathan.
Now, Nathan is, I guess he does construction, but the coolest thing that what I love about him, he's just a nice guy. But
yes, he is.
He hunts for food.
He forages.
He forages. Yes, Thank you. That's the word I was
looking
for.
He forages for wild edible food and mushrooms and...
There's a girl I follow on Instagram, and she's a forager, mm-hmm. but she looks for mushrooms and mm-hmm. shark's teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And she posted something like, you can't eat these mushrooms with alcohol. I didn't realize. There was like something bad that happens with mushrooms and alcohol. Okay. Apparently, you have like this 3-day hangover. I didn't know. If you've ever heard of that.
Well, neither of us drink, so we wouldn't.
You know? See, now when I drank, regardless of the mushroom, I ended up with this 3-day
hangover.
Right,
there you go.
So maybe it wasn't the mushroom.
I'm sure there's some mushrooms that can really help a hangover. Mushrooms are incredible things. I mean, they're the oldest living species. I mean, they're our ancestors.
Yeah.
And Nathan's taught me a lot about them, and we go into the woods and.
Well, apparently, and also there's like a mushroom, you know, we see these mushrooms that pop out of the ground, but the mushroom itself is like underground.
Right.
And it's the biggest giant.
It's a web that just connects.
Yeah. And it can be, I think it's the biggest species that there is. I mean, they'll find mushrooms that go acres.
Oh, yeah.
That's one mushroom.
Yep.
Which is crazy.
I know.
And I guess, you know, if you let anything sit long enough, some sort of mushroom grows on
it. Exactly.
Right. It's probably the building blocks for us today.
I think it is space dust. Yeah. I honestly think it is. So we have a lot to learn from them.
I was just watching something. They were saying that I think Denver was decriminalizing mushrooms, but I don't think they're the kind you eat. Well, they're not the kind you put in spaghetti.
Right. There, you mean we're talking about psilocybin?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they say that, you know, those kind of mushrooms are great for, you know, they're finding out that they can use them towards like depression and anxiety.
They've been using it for a long time.
But not like the mushrooms how I took them before. You know, I think it's like microdosing of it and, you know, not
with a doctor's supervision.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Yeah, not self-medicating with mushrooms.
Right,
that's
exactly.
Probably not a good idea.
Right, now. Probably not.
So where are you now with your music? I mean, are you waiting? Is this getting put out?
I'm in the middle of the biggest project of my life, which is a Netflix original series.
Okay.
I spent most of March in Los Angeles, but I started off in New Orleans for the first time ever. I got to go to New Orleans and for a special inspiration trip, they called it, so that I could absorb the setting and the music. And Kari, my partner, and I, we spent 5 days there. We got into a studio. We kind of walked the streets and, you know, there's just music everywhere and it was just an incredible place. And we also kind of went around the actual setting of, you know, where the story takes place so that we could feel it and just kind of get inspired musically for it. So it was a really productive trip. We made a lot of music there. And then we went to Los Angeles and which is kind of like the home base. And we just cranked out a lot of work. And so we've made a start and I'm returning there in July. I'm going to be there for a month. And we probably will finish all of production in that time. And the show should air in October, around October.
When I think of like scoring music, I always think back to it when I was a kid and Star Wars. And there was this black and white picture of whoever wrote all the music for Star Wars, you might know this name, but it was this black and white picture and he's like playing the piano and this like 75-foot screen of like Han Solo walking across. Yeah. But, you know, is that how you do it? You sit there and watch the show and then kind of put the music?
Sometimes. If it depends on where we are in production, you know. So when our first trip, you know, we were able to watch, you know, a couple rough cuts. But the thing is that they're going to be changed a lot. And so we watched them just so that we could get an idea of, you know, the feeling and, you know. So a lot of the time we are not cutting. It's called cutting to picture. We're not doing that. Later on in the game, there definitely will be times when we do that. But really it's
maybe more intimate moments.
Intimate moments are definitely when they have the final cuts, because there's no sense in scoring something right to the picture when it's just gonna change again, and then you gotta, you know, you're creating more work for yourself. So
I think that scene was like the when Han Solo or Darth Vader walks out and boom.
Right.
So yeah, I definitely
there's
get
a
that.
Lot of, you know, what happens is in the process starts even before I see any footage at all. So I find out what is this about? What's the kind of emotional, what's, you know, the underlying message here? And then I kind of, there'll be some themes that are kind of just born in my head. Like I'll just hear sort of like a melody and I'll sit down. I have a little studio in the yurt. I actually scored my first film 2 months ago in the yurt.
Nice.
By myself. Yeah, it's actually called, it's a 30-minute documentary about the children of veterans, and it's on some PBS channels in some states, and it'll probably go through the school system and stuff like that. It's called Veteran Children. And
I'm a child of a veteran.
Are you?
Yeah.
You should watch this film.
I will.
Yeah. So I scored that in the yurt. So what I'll do is I'll sit down and I'll record some themes and I'll just get inspired. I'll just feel something. And a lot of the times those little yurt sketches will turn into the central themes of the show. And we get to put them to life with Kari and his, you know, strings and production. And it's really cool. It's really cool that a little melody, a little idea in my little yurt, you know, and then I see it on the big screen and it's, you know, telling a story.
You are a hand mover.
I am a hand mover.
You are orchestrating the whole place over there.
I know.
And unfortunately, I have this setup where like this table makes noise, that microphone stand.
I'm so handsy when I talk.
I'm going to have to get a new setup the next time you come back because you're about to take it all down.
I really am. I just found out recently I have some Italian in me and, you know.
How'd you find that out?
I did one of these ancestry kits.
Which one did you do? I've been thinking about it.
It's funny enough, I wanted to do 23andMe. That's what I wanted to do. And it was for my birthday last year. I said, you know what? I want to do this. So I sent a link to Nathan. I said, this is what I want. Okay, I want 23andMe. And he took the link. And when I opened the present, it was MyHeritage. And I'm thinking, did you not get my link? He said, this is the link you sent me. And I'm thinking, that's impossible. So I thought, how bad could it be? Let me do MyHeritage. So I did MyHeritage, did the little swab.
Wait a minute, hold on, back it up. Did he get off that easy?
Yeah.
He just said, okay, sounds good.
I was very perplexed, though. This was the link I sent you?
Well, I don't know. They're not connected,
No,
are
they're
they?
Not.
Okay.
So I was very confused. He said, this is the link you sent me. I'm thinking something went very wrong here. Well, I did MyHeritage because I thought, come on, how big of a deal? I thought I could return this and be a pain, whatever. No, I'm just going to do this. Okay. Did MyHeritage. And the amazing thing that happened out of that was there was a woman who was not on 23andMe. She did MyHeritage, and she turned out to be my second cousin. And we didn't know each other existed. And because I did it with MyHeritage, we've gotten to know each other, and she's been brought into the fold of my family. She was kind of on just her and her son. Meanwhile, I have this huge family of people that she's related to that didn't even know about her. She didn't know about us. And now she is in the mix of our family because of that mistake.
Were you adopted or anything?
No.
See, I was adopted. Mm. And for some reason, I just haven't wanted to do it. I don't know why. Isn't that strange? I mean, you would think I would want to.
But it's a lot. I mean, it could be, I mean, who knows? I mean, I don't know. I thought I was a certain makeup, and I was wrong. So there were surprises even for me, so.
Well, I tried to find my birth parents. I found I was born in 1968. Time was a little different back then, but I found them. Mm-hmm. I've seen, kind of weird. My father's, I saw a picture of my birth father from his prison picture.
Okay.
And he was a drunk.
Mm.
And he was in jail for drinking and fighting police.
Wow.
So I was like, well, that makes sense. And then apparently I have a stepbrother.
Okay.
He was in jail.
Hmm.
Same kind of thing.
Hmm.
So I was like, well, that's interesting. And then they found my birth mother, and they reached out to her, and she said, tell him to never try to contact me ever again.
Ooh.
And I was like, well, the lady at the adoption agency told me that that happens a lot. You know, if a person, especially back in, the 60s,
right.
If someone was to get pregnant, it was a lot of shame in that. And they would tend to, whether they went to a home for women that were giving birth or whatever they, you know, they did. But a lot of times they went somewhere, they had the baby, they left the baby, put the baby up for adoption and went and back to their life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether she would later get married and never mention any of that.
Yeah.
And then to have me come bebopping up in her life and be like, you know, I'm your son.
Right.
And she's like, well, I never had a child. So she says, you know, don't get all upset about it.
Okay.
And I didn't. And okay. I always thought, you know, just out of curiosity, you know, because it was always, I was told that ever since I could understand that I was adopted. My brother always said, you know, if it wasn't for being adopted, oh, geez, hand me that.
Sure.
Or just hang it, answer and hang it up.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me have it.
Sorry if that was you calling.
If you just called,
listening?
We're doing a podcast. Actually, you know what? Hold on.
Okay.
I'm going to just pause this. All right. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
The phone was ringing. We had to get rid of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jesus, just push that door shut. You know who? It's a friend of mine. It doesn't matter. Anyway, can you get it?
Yeah.
There we go. We just shut the dungeon.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my brother was always like, if I, you know, he would tend to throw that out in the air a little bit. Like, all my problems were because I'm adopted. And I'm not sure he still feels like that. But I always, I felt like my life finally came full circle when I had kids.
Hmm.
So I don't know if that's maybe why I haven't really been super interested in
it.
But
sense.
I do. I think about it a lot because mm-hmm. not just my birth parents, but mm-hmm. a whole lot of stuff like
a
you.
Whole
a cousin
lot of
could
stuff.
Just come.
I was not expecting that. Yeah.
Now, do you have a relationship with this person now?
Yeah, we've really gotten to know each other. She's gotten to know my uncles. We have had this reunion plan for June that was going to happen. And she then went on to do 23andMe and Ancestry.com and everything. And she's found a lot more of that side of the family. So I'm getting to know other people too through her that are also cousins. And
now how do you have a cousin that sneaks by?
So my grandfather's parents, I guess, were. There was a lot of siblings on that side, and they all had kids and whatnot. And so my grandfather never talked about his parents or his uncles or anything. So there was this whole, we just didn't know, at least my generation of, you know, cousins, we didn't know anything about this whole wing of the family and that there were kids and there was a lot of cousins and... They all seem to be very artistic too, which is cool. So we're just starting to kind of get to know this whole wing of the family, and I guess they're second cousins. But this woman really was the glue. She brought it all together, and she, you know, she lost her parents, she lost her husband. It was really just her and her son. She had no other relatives. Now she has this whole family that she's starting to get to know. So I thought that was a very fortunate mistake or accident to come from not getting 23andMe when I wanted it and getting this other thing and all this unexpected stuff happened after that. So
you just get the kit, you order it online, I suppose.
You order the kit. It's very simple instructions.
I should send Nathan a link.
Yeah, right.
This is what I want, Nathan.
Exactly. Who knows what you're going to get?
Hey,
you know,
we'll see.
Just go with it. Right. And, you know, you just do the swab of the saliva and you send it in and it takes a couple weeks and they send you electronically a breakdown of what you consist of. So I thought I was a quarter, you know, Russian, a quarter Lebanese, a quarter Irish, and a quarter German. And that's not how it turned out to be.
Where are you? Were you disappointed?
No, I just was a little bit surprised, especially not to see any Irish at all whatsoever when, you know, supposedly my maternal grandmother was 100% Irish. I was like, oh, really? That's interesting. So, but I was also told that if my brothers did the DNA test too, they would have a slightly, so maybe some Irish would come out on them. So I thought that if you're siblings, then you're going to have the same you know, makeup, right. but you don't.
That's not the way
That's not the way it works. So I could have zero Irish turn up and my brothers could have, you know, 15% Irish turn up. I don't know. So that was another thing I learned about that. But it said 52% Ashkenazi Jewish, which I didn't even realize was a ethnicity. I thought it was, you know, Russian, German, whatever, but it comes out as Ashkenazi Jewish. That's 52%, which was perplexing because my mother is not Jewish. I'm like, where does the other 2% come from? So that was not so much a surprise because that's, you know, my dad's side. I had some Italian. I had like 10% Italian. I'm like, who knew?
Yeah,
you
I
know,
can tell
finally,
with those hands.
With the hands, right? It's like everyone always assumes I'm Italian. I'm like, no, but I am.
Wow.
So I had that. Middle Eastern, it said that was not a surprise, but I thought I'd have a little bit more of that. My mother's, you know, father was Lebanese and, you know, all his, you know, they all came from Syria or Lebanon. And I had some Western Asian. I was like, Genghis? Is it Genghis? But no, it's not.
Not Genghis.
It's not Genghis.
What is that? What is Western Asian?
I don't know. I think that's part of the Syrian Lebanese side, you know, that region. Eastern European. I think there was some English in there. But there was definitely a lot more. I was surprised.
It was weird. So when I was doing this, I found out the lady told me that my birth father was had some Jewish.
Yeah.
And did you ever know Matt?
I didn't know him.
So he was Matt was this guy, and you know, I used to talk to, I would talk to him every day, and I go, oh my God, I found out that I have my birth father had Jewish in him, and so he's like, oh, you know, that makes sense. Tight with the money and stuff.
Oh,
and so he starts calling me Arkino Berg.
Arkino Berg.
And I'm laughing and Arkino Steen. And, and I go, you know, and he made a few jokes. And then I go, hey, that's racist. I don't appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, but that was the first time I had kind of experienced that.
Right.
And it was kind of weird, honestly, to kind of be kind of made fun of because of my heritage.
Right, right.
But then I later on found, like that day, that someone's like, well, that's only passed on through the mother.
Technically, yes. So my mother is not Jewish, but I feel like I feel more Jewish than anything else just because I was raised, you know, I had a bat mitzvah. I went to temple. We never went to church. But we celebrated Hanukkah, Christmas, Easter, Passover. We celebrated everything. So I wasn't a very religious Jew, but that was more of the religion and certainly cultural, you know, adherence, I would say, more than anything else. So technically, I'm not technically Jewish because my mother is not Jewish, but, you know.
Well, and that's kind of what, then all of a sudden someone's like, well, you're not Jewish because it's passed on to the mother. And then all of a sudden I was not Jewish.
Right.
So the jokes, you know, could stop with those racist
anti-Semitic.
Yeah, not cool. And I was, and I, you know, I'd never experienced that. So I got a little taste of it. And then, you know, I thought, you know, and I'm not a person that, you know, is that does that kind of stuff. But I definitely would think about, you know, what I say.
Yes.
If I was to say something stupid like that. But
right.
But you know, honestly, you talking about it, you know, makes me really want to do it. I really should do it because I have a lot to learn. And the weird thing is that, you know, with two boys, you know, I told my son Sam the other day, before he goes to bed, I usually lay in bed with him and he makes me tell him a story. Tell me a story, make it funny.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God. So, but I told him, I go, you know, I'm adopted. He's like, what? And, you know, Sam just turned 8. He's like, what? I go, yeah, I'm adopted. Why would your parents not want you? So it was a whole conversation. But for them, you know, it might be nice to know where we come from because we are the start. We're the beginning.
Yeah.
So
it is a lot. I mean, it's definitely, you know, something to think about, you know, weigh it all out. But, you know, you get all these, you'll get a lot of matches, they say, you know, people that share your DNA, you know, cousins, second cousins. So there's been some wild stories of people that have done it that, you know.
I'm a little nervous.
A brother, you know.
What might come popping up.
You know, yeah, exactly. What might come popping up, exactly.
Well, and I also was kind of, I felt like I was the under the stand. with the understanding that a lot of these, whether it's 23andMe, Ancestry.com, they all kind of use the same database. There's one company that I thought was collecting all this DNA data.
I don't know. It seems like there are three separate entities.
There are.
Because there's the, you know, for the with the case of my long lost cousin, she hadn't done the other ones, or she had done Ancestry or something, but I think each company has their own database, so you go with them and then you're matched in their database. Hmm. So at least to my knowledge, who knows, maybe it's all one big company,
one big pot they ladle from.
Yes, exactly. A lot of people are freaked out about, you know, giving their DNA away, but the way I see it is, if the government wants my DNA, they'll get it. They can get it easily.
It's not hard to get DNA. They bust a lot of people by stealing
soda can and
Starbucks cups out of the trash can.
Cups, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways to get it. So, yeah.
So, what do you do when you're not making awesome music?
When I'm not making awesome music, so when I'm home, I perform locally.
Blue Moon.
So I will be, actually, yes, Blue Moon, absolutely. I just got my schedule for this coming season, so I will.
And let me just say one thing. You know, I started doing this podcast, the first question is, how much money do I make doing these? I don't make any money doing podcasts. I don't charge you to do this.
Right.
I find this as a total honor that you would even do it with me, so
well,
I appreciate
it. I'm honored
it.
That you asked me.
But up until really... You know, I don't know if anybody's been listening. So I started putting these on a thing called Audio Boom, and this puts it out everywhere.
Cool.
And I looked at it, and I had 100. Well, the other day I had 87 listeners.
Nice.
And then the next day I had 125.
That's awesome.
So that doesn't mean that this is valuable, but
no, but
you
it's
know,
really
maybe
cool.
We can.
People are listening.
You know, the premise is always about one small business helping another.
If
my little Rehoboth Social podcast business can help you,
right?
Then That's what it's about.
Awesome.
So
yeah.
Maybe the listeners, maybe we will help you get some people come down and listen to you.
Or
you are
watch,
terrific.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very
or
much.
Or watch some, I'm definitely.
Watch some of these shows. I mean, they're important. They're very important stories. You know, the Khalif Browder story, like I said, it's on Netflix. It's called Time. Rest in Power, Trayvon Martin story that you can get on Amazon now streaming.
And maybe you can write that. Just the other thing I'm learning about is when I post a podcast describing what the podcast is about. So maybe if you could write those down for me.
Yeah, I'd be happy
to. And I can just type it into the description so that if someone looks at it, I'm giving you the best that I can.
Yeah,
but I didn't mean to sidetrack you.
No,
I want to hear
okay.
about the, you know,
yeah, so
the
I'm
Blue
performing.
Moon, you've been doing that a while.
Yeah. That was the first gig I got when I moved down here. It was really cool. I moved here. I didn't know really anyone except for Nathan and, his family. And I came down and I asked some of his close friends, who is how I met you, Ann and James, said, so...
And James has been on the podcast.
Oh, I was going to ask. I'm glad.
Yeah,
yes.
He's been on it.
Good. I asked, so what is the, you know, where should I go and try to get gigs here? You know, and the first thing that was said was Blue Moon. And so I thought, all right. So I just showed up. I just went knocking on the door, you know, and I left my card and I just said, I'm new to the area. I'm a entertainer. I'm a pianist. And... you know, this is me, and here you go. And that card was taken to the owner.
Was that, did Joyce own Blue?
Not anymore. No,
okay,
no,
she has since
lit.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So taken to the owner, and a couple days later, I got an email, and he said, I just was given your card. I would like to talk to you about your talent. I said, whoa, okay. So I guess he had watched some YouTube videos or something. I don't know. So I showed up and he said, you know, it just so happens we're making our schedule for the summer and we're looking for a brunch, you know, pianist, entertainer, and you seem perfect for this. And you kind of just breezed in right at the right time. And, you know, we'd like to book you. And he said, first, I'd like to book you for my wedding. And him and his partner were getting married. And, you know, that was like a week or two, like I just landed, you know, here and already I had, you know, my summer of Sundays set up and it was very exciting. So this will be my fourth or even fifth.
And the Blue Moon, it's season. You know, it's no, That's a big gig.
It is. It is. It's a
wonderful... I mean, it's a little bar in town on Baltimore Avenue.
Yeah, but Sunday brunch... I mean, they have wild shows at night.
So, but Blue Moon's it's a gay bar. Restaurant.
It's a phenomenal restaurant. I mean, but they have nightlife. Well,
and I was going to get to that part.
I just
wanted to kind of, in case somebody didn't know, it's a gay restaurant.
It's known as
it always has been. I don't know if there's... If that's the thing, but they've also been they've been known for that, and they've been known for great food.
Yep, great food and great shows and entertainment.
And then great shows. We've been to the drag shows. There was a guy I don't know how many Christmases, but we went to a drag show for Christmas, and the guy passed away. He went to, I guess he did this in the summer, and then he went to Mexico for that.
Oh, God,
Do you know who I was talking
about? Yeah,
he was so funny. So that was a sad thing to have happen, but it's a great restaurant.
It is. And it's just a fixture, on the beach. And, so I've been playing for their brunches there for this, either my fourth or fifth, I've lost track of years at this point, but, season. So I'm going to be there, Sunday of Memorial Weekend, which is the 26th.
Okay.
I'll be there on Father's Day. I'll be there on Labor Day Sunday, and then two Sundays in September. So five total. They started alternating. There's a couple other musicians that will be doing Sundays also, which is good because I'll be, like I mentioned, I'm going to be away for a month doing this Netflix thing. So I play there. Actually played for Mother's Day yesterday at the Peninsula, which is a very nice golf club. I was there last year for when Joe Biden came. It was a Beau Biden charity event, and Joe was there, and I donated my music, piano playing and singing, and got to meet Joe. And, so I'll be going back there. It's next Monday. They're having that event again. It'll be under the radar if he does, but I don't think he's planning.
I thought about seeing if Joe would come do my podcast.
You never know.
Well, I don't know if I mean, that sounds fun and everything, but I'm not sure I'm smart enough to talk to him.
Oh, God.
Because
he's really easy to talk to. He was I enjoyed meeting him.
I don't know if you remember, there was a Saturday Night Live gig with Chris Farley, and he was interviewing. He used to do this kind of the sketch where he would interview musicians, and I think he was interviewing Paul McCartney, and he's like, you remember when you were playing like that big stadium? He's like, oh, yeah, I remember. I was there. Yeah, it was really cool. That's kind of like how I would be. Remember, Joe, when that was awesome.
That
was so awesome.
Yeah, he was really, really cool and laid back and easy to talk to.
Well, and you're also kind of related to like Rob Waters.
Yes.
Because Nathan is Rob's
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I've had some fun. I remember when Rob was telling me, because this was a question I had for somebody else. I was like, does Joe Biden own a house down here at the beach, or does he rent? And we don't have to get into that. But one day Rob was at his house, and he starts seeing these guys in polos and collared shirts and khaki shorts, just kind of walking around the neighborhood, or at least around his house.
Yep.
And then next thing you know, Joe Biden shows up.
Yep.
I guess that's summer Secret Service.
Yeah, I guess so.
Summer Secret Service, summer not.
Yeah, there you go.
But I think Joe was renting a house kind of next door to Rob, right?
I think so.
And, but somebody else just told me that he now has a house in the Glade, not the Glade, the Pine, whatever that nice neighborhood is back there.
Yeah, I think he
does. I don't know, identify where it is, but.
I know.
So that'd be interesting because, if he wins. If he became the president, he could really stink up the town if he comes down for a weekend.
He really could.
Shut down the whole town because the president's coming through.
Absolutely.
Kind of be cool, but also be a little strange.
It would be something. Yep. So I'll be doing that Monday coming up. And I play at Rehoboth Country Club. I'm one of their house musicians there. So I sometimes play at the Atlantic Hotel in Berlin, which is a cool little place. And, just do some parties and weddings. And I just, that's what I do when I'm home and I'm, in the yurt building my music library.
I can remember going to, I think it was Mother's Day brunch at the club. Or was it, maybe it was
Easter.
And I come down and I look over and there you are playing. Yeah. I'm like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
I'm playing. I was like,
I'm working.
Well, so what happens if you, if you were on, you know, doing these things that you do, these, you know, for Netflix and stuff, right. And you, what happens if you were, you won an Emmy? So now does your price go up?
I was pondering this just today.
You were thinking, because at some point, you know, you all of a sudden become a featured artist.
I'm an Emmy winning composer. Do I even do these gigs anymore?
Well, could you do a gig? Like, could you do a small concert here in Rehoboth? Would you have the material?
I could do a concert. You know, it's funny because I've spent so many years being background music.
Right.
That well, that's kind of I'm what was comfortable up. Being in the background. I'm comfortable being in the background of a film. I'm comfortable being behind the scene. I'm comfortable with people talking and having conversations while I'm playing. It's interesting when I think about giving a concert, I get all, tense because it's a very different thing when everyone's just sitting, listening quietly to you. It's definitely a lot more pressure.
Do you struggle
before.
With being good enough?
Oh, yeah. That's always been.
Isn't that strange? Because yeah. You know, as a guy looking at you that knows everything you do, and you're clearly good enough. But as a person that's been on the other side, and I'm obviously not doing anything where I'm winning an Emmy, but, you know, every little thing I go to try to do, I'm already not good enough.
Right. I think it's just an ingrained thing that I'm trying to, you know, a lot of us have. And, you know, it's definitely doesn't serve me any good, you know, but and also just being an artist, and I think in this age of the internet and people being able to share their talent and their art so much more, like you can really fall into the trap of like comparing yourself, you know, left and right to what other people are doing and how good they are, or successful they are.
I've been going through that with this podcast, you know.
Yeah.
I sit here and do a podcast and then I go home at night and watch Joe Rogan
interview,
you know, Elon Musk. And I think, why do I bother? But you just keep chugging along.
You just got to keep doing what you do.
You do you.
We just all have to do us and, you know, do that to the best of our ability.
Do you exercise?
I do.
You know, it's funny. You know, I run. And I always say, you know, running turns me into a musician and turns me into a poet. And it turns me into like a philosopher. Mm-hmm. You know, you run, you struggle, whatever the exercise you do. But do you find yourself like that wall of self-centered fear that comes up in all of our lives, like it makes it hard to do anything. You're like, I'm not good enough at anything. But then when I go for a run or I suffer and grind it out and get back really to basics, you know, that wall comes down and all of a sudden I feel like, oh, you know, I could be a composer, even though I don't know how to write music.
Right?
But, you know, I start to feel like I'm capable.
Yeah.
Do you have to do, like I don't even know if you have a thing called writer's block or if you get to a place where you're struggling. Is there something you do to kind of knock yourself out of it?
To get out of it? It's a really good question. I use a tool that my very dear friend, it's called Journal Speak, Nicole Sachs, who's local. She's her work is incredible. She's helped a lot of people. And I actually started doing it maybe 2 years ago when I was suffering with these weird symptoms that no doctor could help me with. And she gently suggested I tried her Journal Speak, and that helps me with not only did it clear up this bizarre thing that was happening with my eyes, but it actually unblocks me because it gets rid of like all this, the crud and all those voices in my head that are telling me, you know, don't even bother, you know, why, you know, you suck or, you waited too long or, you know, whatever the voices are telling me, which really stand in the way of the creativity.
Yeah.
They really, really do. So if I sit there and it's really a good daily practice because it's just 20 minutes and you just really like stream of consciousness. See, there I go again, knocking shit. Excuse my language.
It's all right.
And, you know,
112 people.
112 people.
61 of them are now offended.
Oh, very sorry. So
I didn't need them anyway.
Right. There you go. So, yeah, I do this journaling and I find that to help a lot. You know, going on walks, actually going on long walks, like sometimes on the trail or on the boardwalk, listening to the greats, you know, sometimes classical music really does it to me. I and then just with the scenery, and so like I'm I get into a state, and it just kind of like opens up my creative pathways and gets my brain working in a different way. So listening to music while I move, yes, that really helps a lot.
Well, you know, you mentioned the trail, Junction Breakwater Trail, yeah, which is a great gift that we were blessed
really
with
is
to have here. But there's,
yeah,
and I don't know if you know where I live, but I, you know where Wolfneck Road is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you walk down the trail from the right from there, there's that bridge. And I always say, you know, if I woke up on this bridge, mm-hmm, stood up and looked, mm-hmm, over the edge, I'd say, wow, that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But when I run to that bridge, or walk, or, mm-hmm, whatever it is, mm-hmm, when I suffer to the bridge, mm-hmm, I get to the bridge and I look over the rail and I go, wow, this is beautiful. And I think I am capable of doing anything I want. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that battle of that self and, you know, humility. And you always, yeah, hear me talk about
that
it.
That bridge is a very big spiritual place for me too.
Yeah, it's a great...
It really is.
It's a great spot.
I just, whatever is on my mind, I mean, you can't help but just feel grateful and humble and just, you know, good when you're standing there.
Right, but it's also like how I get to it. Like
how
if
you
I,
get to it.
You know,
yeah,
if I get to it, just, you know, if, like I said, if I woke up there, I'd be,
yeah,
like, hey.
Yeah.
But when I run,
yeah,
and I'm,
right,
crying about,
yeah,
it inside, yeah, ooh, and I, right, get there and I, yeah, go, God damn it, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to score some music for a Netflix series.
There you
series.
Go, right. You can do anything.
And then James goes, you don't know how to write music. And I go, shut up, James.
Right.
I've got this.
Exactly. You know,
well, that's interesting
because,
you know, it is, you know, with anything you do, you always, there's always those voices that say, hey.
There are. Yes. So, and really, I always have them right before a project, you know, even though like the last one was a great success and we did it and everyone's happy and it's like you're only as good as your, you know, next thing.
Well,
and I always, whenever I'm presented with a new challenge, like a brand new slate, like a whole new story, those voices will start creeping in, you know, like, well, you're not going to be able to do it this time, you're not going to be able to write the themes this time, it's not going to come. And honestly, especially when I get together with my partner and it's just go, I mean, he doesn't really give me any time to think about anything. It's like, all right, ready, record, go, you know? And a lot of the time it comes out of me like in that moment and there it is.
Well, and I think that's just how that's the real Danielle, you know,
yeah,
this, and that's the real, you know, like,
yeah,
just this. I mean, we sit down, we start talking, and it's
exactly
fine.
Exactly, yeah.
But
when
before
you're in
you
the
got
moment,
here, I'm like,
fine.
I,
right,
hope this isn't tough. So,
right,
we're just not great.
I
we
know.
Don't. We're not sis boom ba on ourselves.
The lesson is in the moment.
I'll never forget when Matt, he was, you know, he'd won the James Beard Humanitarian of the Year Award.
Mm.
I mean, you won it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over and he's like, let's go for a walk. And we were walking around the block and he goes, you know, sometimes I just feel like they're going to figure out I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like, well, Matt, you obviously know what you're doing because you just won the award. But
it's
that's
amazing
how, you know, he would still, with all
even
that
with
he had
all
accomplished,
that, yeah,
he's like, I think they're going to figure out I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
And that was a big lesson to me because,
yeah,
we're never safe.
Right. Yeah.
What's a daily reprieve? Sometimes a minute,
yeah,
reprieve.
Right. No, it's true. It's true. And I felt like a scam. You know, I just felt like, well, I'm not a real composer. I'm not a real this because I don't do this and do this. And then at one point a few years ago, it's like, well, why don't you take some courses in like music production if you don't feel like you know a lot? And so I did. I took all these courses. I would go to New York and back and I learned how to do all these technical things. And it was like, huh, look at that.
So did you learn that you weren't, or did you learn that you were, and now that you're even better?
I was, and I learned how to do the things that intimidated me and made me feel like I wasn't legit. Mm. So there's a course for that. There's an app for that. You can go on YouTube and learn anything you want to learn.
And the funny thing is you mentioned it, and we kind of started this off with that, you know, the millennials.
Yeah.
You know, but you're doing the work. You know, this is, you know, I walk down the stairs at Rehoboth Beach Country Club and I look over and there you are playing piano. So
right,
it's not like you're just at this level. You're, yeah, at the, you're doing the, and now I won't say it's the grunt work because
a lot, I mean,
it's the foundation that, you know, makes you awesome. But that's, you know, you're doing the work.
Yeah, I guess I am.
So, and
yeah,
I recognize it.
Thank you. And you're doing it too.
Well,
yeah,
we're having fun.
Look at this setup.
It's a little.
You guys can't see it, but it's impressive.
Well, next week, I'm excited. This is exciting that you did this. I appreciate it. But so next week, Urban Float.
Nice. I've done it a few times.
Oh, have we did it yesterday?
You did it?
It was
great. For the first time?
Yeah, and I asked him. I had a lot of clients who were like, I don't know about, you know, this and that, and yada, yada. And
right.
I'm like, well, I don't either. You know, I don't know anything about it. So right. I reached out to them, and I said, hey, would you come on my podcast? So
Carlos
is coming, and the girl that runs the...
Uh-huh. I don't remember her name, but I met her. She was very
She has a unique name, and I apologize, and I won't forget it when she gets
here. Yeah.
But they're both coming. So now cool. I had to order another microphone.
Nice.
And my buddy Craig was just here hanging this shelf above me. Cool. God, hope it doesn't fall on my head. Oh. But we're going to mount these blocks here so that these microphones can mount into these blocks and not be connected to this table. So,
okay.
You know, we're stepping
See,
it up.
It's growing.
It's growing.
Yeah.
You know, I just like doing this.
Yeah, it's fun.
You know, this is fun. Get
Absolutely.
To chat. And,
yeah. Who knows who's listening and how the ripple will go, you know, out and help people. We don't know.
You never know, but I know
well, we have to do it.
You got
to
do it.
You got
to
show
well,
up.
Well, and you
it.
Know, it's like, I remember when that Danielle Moo turned out, she just won an Emmy. What the hell? How'd that happen? Oh, I've been working at it every day for the last 4 years, sir.
Actually, the last almost 40 years. I'm turning 40 in July, Tom. I don't know if you knew that. It's a big
I didn't
big
know
moment.
That, but yeah. I'm 50.
Now everyone knows. Oh, really?
So I don't care. I get to, oh, you're just a baby.
Just a baby.
Well,
no, I feel like I'm at the beginning.
And my wife is turning 33, and she's acting
goodness.
Like, you know, it's the end of the world.
Wow.
And I'm like... birthday week, she says.
Birthday
We're having birthday week.
Nice.
And it was Mother's Day.
Aw. Right.
I mean, yeah. She's a great mom, so, yeah. I, you know, that's why I went and did the float thing.
Celebrate.
Did you like floating?
I did. I liked it a lot.
Do you keep the music on?
I do not. No. The two times I've done it, I had the 5 minutes of music before and the 5 minutes that tell you that it's over. And then just dark and silent.
See, I did. That's how I did it. And I think I would like that jungle music going. And it's not jungle music. It's
right.
jungle sounds.
Right. There's
but
a difference.
I kind of was like under the water and it was like stereo.
Yeah, it's
And it
cool.
would come around and then it sounded like the birds would come around my head. And I was like, okay, yeah. this is a little trippy.
And you had a dark?
Oh, black. It? Yeah, it was
dark.
Totally black.
Yeah.
And when I first got it, I'm like, all right, don't move. You're
right,
floating.
Right.
But then at, you know, 40 minutes later, I'm like, start swimming around,
yeah,
spinning around.
Yeah,
and.
Yeah. I know. It's interesting what happens.
You don't get to float around naked too often.
You really don't.
You don't. So
you really don't.
And the guy's like, you got to be naked. And I was like, oh, my God, really? Oh, Jesus. So, I mean, I guess, what if you just said, I don't want to be naked? Would they let you wear a bathing suit?
Yeah.
Because he said they didn't want the detergent to get into the water from, you know.
Oh, I'm sure people will leave something on if they want to.
If they want to. I mean, once that door shut, no, God knows only what's going on in there.
Exactly.
I remember as a teenager, there was they used to have this place where you could go and rent a hot tub.
Hmm.
Did you ever see anything like that?
No.
And we used to get a bunch of friends together and we'd go get wasted at these hot tubs.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. It was crazy. They don't do that anymore.
No, I have not ever heard of that.
Well, this is in Albuquerque. It's a little more of the wild, wild west.
All right. It was an Albuquerque thing.
So listen, I appreciate it. That was
thank you, Tom.
Hour and 20 minutes.
Me. Wow. That just flew by.
It just flies by.
What did we say?
Yeah, I listened. You said a lot of good stuff.
Okay,
you said interesting stuff.
I hope I
stuff.
Didn't say anything bad.
It didn't get bad till I got involved at
okay.
the end. The next thing you know, we're partying in hot tubs. But
right.
what you said was great. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Will you maybe come back another time? Keep
sure.
us posted.
Absolutely.
Will you bring the Emmy? Can I drink from it?
Yeah.
Is that a thing you can... That's not a cup.
No, it's not a cup.
It's
no.
a speakerphone.
It's
or
like
a
woman's
oh.
body and like little figurine. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
all I really want is a nomination. That would be great.
So are you nominated?
We're being...
Considered.
They're going to vote for us to be nominated.
Okay.
We're in the running to be nominated for Best Original Score for a Documentary.
Well, maybe after it's all done and the nominations are out and, you know, even after the voting and the choosing, maybe then we
yes.
can have you back.
Sure. I would be happy to come back. Yeah. When the Netflix thing's about to come out, we'll tell everyone about it. And,
absolutely.
You know, so they can watch it. Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, Danny.
My pleasure, Tommy.
And we'll see you next time.
All right.
All right, dear.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.